My name is Darren Hupke, and this is Pixels and Polygons. Welcome to another episode of Pixels and Polygons. I am Darren Hupke, and I don't know why I'm introducing myself again here. I'm back from the Portland Retro Gaming Expo. That was over the weekend. My wife and I were up there in Portland for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That's where the release of 32-Bit Library Volume 4 happened, so that was new for folks to buy in person. Had a great time. I got the table next to Brian from RetroGameBooks.com, so that was fun just hanging out and chatting in the downtime and just having the typical convention experience, really. Just fun meeting folks and getting in front of people and talking about it and everything. So I got a few cool purchases myself and just had a great time. So that is out of the way. Now I'm just back to focusing on the traditional and regular stuff. So I've been working on a book kind of talking about the history of Final Fight that I'll be diving back into. I have a preview of that on my Patreon page. I know I talk about that every week, but that's the whole point of this. Up front here, I can advertise and promote and talk about what I'm working on. So if you head over to my Patreon page, patreon.com/Darren Hupke, you can see that post and see kind of some preview pages of what I'm working on for that Final Fight history book. I'm tentatively calling it Beat 'em Up Volume 1 at the moment. But yeah, that's what I'll be focused on. And then I'll get back into the swing of things doing a greatest hits collection of 32-bit library for Volume 5. I'll also be kind of creating a poll and the ability for folks to kind of help vote on which games I'll include in that volume beyond just to kind of fill up the like a 50 game count total for that roster. So follow along for free. Just check the link and you can see it all there. There is an option for a paid option, but you are not obligated to do that whatsoever. That is there for folks who do want to maybe participate further and be involved with some of the book creating that I'm doing. It's also got a bonus podcast called Single Player that I've released a couple bonus episodes of in this main feed here. So if you do like that, you can do that. But all the other writing and all the other stuff is there for free for you all to kind of check out. So appreciate your time and listening to me plug that Patreon page. But that's where you kind of head to check out a lot of the stuff I'm working on right now. Otherwise, this week, we're talking about our favorite gaming consoles of all time. I have a new guest, Aiden Moyer, is first-time episode for him. He introduces himself on his segment. He's in the first segment. He wrote an awesome book on like the history of Japanese RPGs and coming to the West. It's awesome. I'm currently a big fan of it. It's, you know, on my desk actually right here next to me because I brought it with me up to Portland. But you can take a look at that there. And then on the back half, I have longtime guest and longtime friend, Austin. So we both spent time answering the question of our favorite gaming console of all time. So hopefully you enjoy the episode. And I think that's all I got, really, for the upfront stuff. Links below for some of the guests' info and where you can find more of their work. But otherwise, enjoy it, and we will see you all next week. Bye. Well, cool. Welcome to another episode of Pixels and Polygons. This episode, I've got a new guest. So with it being their first episode, I'll let them introduce themselves and kind of fill us in on some of the stuff they do, who they are. And after that, once we get to know them, we'll jump into the icebreaker and main episode content. So new guest, tell us who you are. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Yeah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. My name is Aiden Moher. I'm a writer and a games journalist, author of a book called Fight Magic Items, The History of Final Fantasy, Dragon Quest, and the Rise of Japanese RPGs in the West. And I've been writing about video games and books and video game books for a long time now. And, you know, that kind of fills up my hobby space. And now it's a fun profession of mine as well. So writing about books and writing books.
Cool. Is there like a primary source, like people can go and read your stuff, or is it kind of a little bit everywhere?
I mean, it is a little bit everywhere, but the best place is probably I have a newsletter called Astrolabe, where I collect anything new that I've written, and I have a whole big like bibliography of work prior to that. And then I also publish a lot of like unique bespoke content on Astrolabe as well. So you can find that at astrolabe.aidenmoher.com or just search my name plus Astrolabe. I cover a lot of gaming news there. I cover, you know, I really like retro gaming hardware, modern games that sort of like work on retro aesthetics or retro gameplay, stuff like that, old Japanese RPGs, new Japanese RPGs. And so I write there quite frequently about those things. And then I also collate anything that I've written elsewhere. So that's probably the best place to start.
Cool. I'll have a link to that in like the show description. Whatever podcast platform you're listening to should have that. But cool. Thanks for jumping on. Yeah, you randomly just scrolling through Blue Sky. Like we follow each other, but you had shared like an anniversary coming up for your book, and you're like, yeah, we should I should be on a podcast. And so I'm like, yeah, how about you do mine? And yeah, that's how we arranged this whole thing. So it worked out.
That's right. It's great. I love talking with other people who love video games. And that's right. My book is. In 2 days, it'll be 2 years old, which is wild to me because it feels like I was just writing it. I wrote like the majority of it in the front car, my front seat of my car during the pandemic. I needed to get out of the house. I'd drive somewhere to the beach with my laptop, write the book in the front seat.
Wow.
And that was like that would have been 3 years ago now or whenever, like thick of the pandemic. So time is a crazy construct.
Yeah. Wild. Okay. Well, yeah, if you haven't read the book, I've mentioned it before, but, it's a cool book. I'm, a big fan of it and everything. So, take a look at that. And as, like I said, links will be in the show description, but we can jump into the icebreaker. Then this question you have not read in advance, the main episode you have, but, we'll start with, something not too crazy. So what collectible would you need to find if your life was a video game? This one's fun.
Oh, gosh. Man, I got expensive hobbies. So just like some gold coins, some rupees would be great. You know, I'm into, like I said, old video games, but I've just picked up a vinyl record habit, which is not great. Old books and stuff like that. So, you know, we all need more money, but more rupees to spend on records and old video games would probably be okay. Otherwise, you know, what are we looking at? You know, when you go around on old video games and collect like, you know, or even new video games and you collect like a million books, just lore books, and it just tells you like, you know, it's random stories written for the game. Like, you know, maybe I have a huge collection of lore books sitting in my Skyrim house, you know, that nobody reads but me.
Okay, that's cool. I like that. Yeah, the vinyl itch. I don't even. Well, I guess my oldest daughter, she was gifted a record player, but we don't actually have one set up or anything for the home. But I will buy like one or two vinyl like records like every couple of months, maybe just like a handful every year, realistically. And I don't know why I'm doing that. Like, it's not like I want to get into that world or like be consumed by that, because I know it's just going to be another expense. But it's usually like some random band that I liked in high school who just like has some really odd like deluxe, like, hey, here's like a 3 LP like re-release remaster thing of this thing. And I'm like, well, the other thing's out of print and hard to find, maybe this will be worth it. I'll just keep it on my shelf and not actually be able to listen to it.
Huge part of like my, you know, vinyl journey so far has been exactly what you're talking about, like collecting and recollecting or rebuilding a library of like a lot of the bands and albums I used to listen to in high school. Right. I had them on cassette, had them on CD. Those are gone. And there's just something about the tangibility of like picking up a record, even if you don't listen to it, even if you stream the music, but like having it and owning it and feeling like there's a little bit of a stronger personal connection with you and those artists or that music. I don't know. It just feels good. Yeah. Right. I can't do that. I can't casually collect records. So I kind of did what you're describing. I was like, oh, hey, like I found Smash by the Offspring, which was like the first tape I ever owned. I was like, I'm going to buy this on vinyl. And then like a week and a half later, I had, you know, like a turntable. I had the amp, I had speakers, and I was like, you know, updating records on discogs.org or whatever it is, you know, like the Wikipedia for albums. And I was like, well, that escalated quickly. But now I'm trying to be a little more smart about where I'm spending my money and what I'm spending it on. But
yeah, I feel like as long as I hold out and not buy the record player, like I won't ever go too crazy. Like I have a couple of video game soundtracks as well, but again, it's just one of those things like, hey, I really like this game. It came with something extra, or it's like got like a thick booklet to it. Cool. This will be nice on the shelf. Yeah. And
they're beautiful too. Like records, you know, in the sleeves or if they're gatefold, they come with like a nice heavy or like, you know, colorful record in there. They come with liner notes, you know, it's just a nice product to have. And we just don't get that as much as we used to, right? Like even in gaming, like we used to get these thick manuals and maps and all this stuff with our games. And now you can get that if you spend $250 on like the collector's edition, but you don't, you know, you don't really get that premium experience. Whereas vinyl, I think because it died off and that has come back, kind of wants to be that. He recognizes that it's going to be like a premium experience for people. It's going to be something that like people can get that music for cheaper and easier elsewhere. So like make this a product that people feel like happy and proud to own, which I think is kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. It's found that niche. Cool. Well then, getting nostalgic there. So it kind of like transitions, I think, nicely into this question, but for, the main episode's question, I kind of would like to know what your favorite gaming console of all time is, and then just elaborate a little on why that is.
Yeah, man, I've been thinking about this like all night since we settled on this question, and through the morning, today. And I'm a big RPG guy, and that's sort of like my bread and butter. I wrote a whole book about like, you know, Japanese RPGs and their transition to the West. And excuse me. So like the natural response, I was like, oh, Super Nintendo, or wait, no, PlayStation, you know, that golden age. And I was like, ah, but how could I choose between those two? And then I kind of kept thinking, extrapolating out from there. And I kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, if I had to really nail down my favorite console, I'd look at the Game Boy Advance, because portability, like it came to me at the right time in my life. I was in my early 20s when it came out, you know, 19 or 20. I had just got my first job. So like the very first thing I bought with my very first paycheck was a Game Boy Advance SP and a copy of Advance Wars. And so it came around at this right time where I was sort of transitioning from, you know, being at home a lot and being at school a lot, busy, seeing friends a lot, to like, you know, the sort of different part of my life where I was traveling to work a lot. I lived on and grew up on a small island. So to go to work, I needed to take a 20-minute ferry ride. And then, you know, I worked at Chapters, which is like the Canadian version of Barnes and Noble. And it was a 20-minute drive past the ferry. So, you know, I was on my own a lot. And so I'd always, you know, grown up reading books, but having like the Game Boy with me, and I'd grown up with a Game Boy, but having the Game Boy Advance was like, the Game Boy felt like Game Boy games. They felt like something that was like, yeah, this is cool. I love Super Mario Land and Super Mario Land 2 and Link's Awakening, but they feel like kind of compromised or smaller games than what I'm playing at home. Whereas the Game Boy Advance came around, and you know, at that point, Nintendo was sort of transitioning to the N64 and 3D gaming with their home console stuff. But the Game Boy Advance just felt like a Super Nintendo on the road, like playing full-fledged classic, like golden age Japanese RPGs like Final Fantasy VI or, you know, stuff like that on the go, sitting on the ferry playing Final Fantasy VI or rediscovering Final Fantasy V, like on the go, on the bus, or while I'm waiting for, you know, my ferry to show up. Like that just blew my mind, and it stuck with me, and it came at such a transitional time for me, for the gaming industry, that it really helped legitimize gaming as something that wasn't just something that I did at home, kind of, you know, quietly in my bedroom or by myself in my bedroom. It was like, it was something that I could take with me, and it was a public thing, and it was something that I could share with friends more easily. And the Game Boy Advance just brought everything that the Game Boy did that was great, that portability, the shareability, the social aspects, but combined it with something that felt like a robust home console. Like, I was still loved Super Nintendo games at that point, and all of a sudden I had one in my pocket. And so, you know, as I kind of boiled down all of these consoles, you know, I could, the same could apply to the Sony's PSP, right? Like, it was like, had all these its own games, a lot of good unique games just on the PSP, but then it also had all the PlayStation classics. So it was like having a, you know, portable PlayStation in your pocket. And then if you go all the way up to the Vita, you kind of have the Vita library and the play, you know, the PSP library and the PlayStation library. But for me, it was like the Game Boy Advance, just really like combining home gaming with like on the go gaming in a way that felt really explosive at the time, and really like led to a shift where I think, like, because I was on the go going to work, my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, you know, lived off island. And so I was at her house a lot. And I think if it hadn't been for the Game Boy Advance and then, you know, the DS later on, I might have fallen out of gaming a bit there because I wasn't at home, you know, in my bedroom as much as I had been before that. And so I just think that that came around at such a unique time for me, but also for the industry, as that first wave of kids who grew up in the 80s started to grow into adulthood, we were able to take games with us in a way that just didn't exist before. And so for that reason, I just kind of had to settle on the Game Boy Advance, having Super Mario, or like Mario and Luigi, having access to all the Final Fantasy games, like, you know, Sword of Mana, like looking at, you know, that, like the remakes of the Game Boy games that came out. Tales of Phantasia, you were getting games that Super Nintendo games from Japan that never made it here on the Super Nintendo, but all of a sudden found life on the Game Boy Advance. And then just really like interesting experiences that never would have worked on the Super Nintendo here in North America, like in the States or Canada, like Advance Wars never really would have like taken off, I think, on consoles, playing it on TV screens. All these great new experiences. You had this sort of time capsule of the 8 and 16-bit era, because they, you know, they also released stuff like the original Zelda on, you know, like its own little cart. And so you had like, it felt like a museum piece, but also something that was pushing forward what you kind of expected of portable gaming.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, I had the same thing. I've never really thought about it that way, that like maybe I would have fallen out of gaming if it wasn't for like the Advance. But like that was around the time, like I was, let's say I was a freshman in high school, I think, when the Game Boy Advance like first came out. And so like, I remember kind of grabbing that, and like, I would have to take the bus to school and everything. And like, that was like a long, like a lot of time for me. And then when I met my wife now, she was my, you know, girlfriend in high school, she was gifted like a Game Boy Advance SP from like an aunt. And so like, I like was like, oh, you're going to play this? Like, well, if you're not going to play it, like I'll play it. But like, she really wanted to play it too. And she was not like into games. Like I grew up like hardcore, like obsessing over games and everything. So like she had her own Advance, or she had her own SP, and like we bought like Harvest Moon, Friends of Mineral Town. Yeah. And she was like hooked to that. And like, we both were. And like, yeah, like it kept like I was not in the house. Like I was kind of being transient then anyway. And so realizing that like it is kind of like the same effect, I think, without that system, like kind of bridging me into like us moving in together and then getting back into console gaming and all that stuff, or at least being able to spend like significant amounts of time together doing that. That SP was special. Yeah. That's
Cool. And like, you know, when we, when we eventually lived together too, like, you know, that was years after the SP came out, or the Game Boy Advance. But, you know, like when you're living in a tiny little apartment and there's one TV, you know, my wife was in school, like I couldn't just take over the TV whenever I wanted to play console games. Right. And so like portability through a lot of my 20s was like key to me. It was like a primary driver of like what kept me invested in games. And that started, it started with the Game Boy way back when. Like I have fond memories again of playing my original Game Boy in the backseat of my parents' car while we were waiting for the ferry. So like, you know, it goes back further than that, but there was something sort of more liberating about the Game Boy Advance because it was something I bought with my own money. I could afford to buy the games by myself, you know, like I wasn't relying on my parents to do that. And so it sort of just symbolizes that sort of like freedom and growing up, and that sort of like you know, really major time post high school in a person's life. That I think is just, you know, you just can't replicate that. Even with the great consoles like the PS2 and the, you know, the Super Nintendo and PlayStation, you know, like all of those have great games and I have great memories with them, but none of them really like changed my relationship with games quite in the way that the Game Boy Advance did. And it was accessible too. You know, you talk about like your wife being gifted one by an aunt or whatever. Game Boy Advance was like $99 at one point, right? Like it was so accessible and affordable for kids, or for parents to get for kids. And you just have kind of lost that a little bit, right? Like the Switch is the most affordable. You get a Switch Lite, but it's still going to run you $300 Canadian, right? And that's just not the same as when you could get a brand new Game Boy for $99.99, Game Boy Advance. And so like, I do miss that level of accessibility for console gaming. And I don't know that we're going to get that back. I think handhelds are seeing a big resurgence for a lot of good reasons, probably similar to some of the reasons that we're talking about, right? Like, you know, people going through those transitional periods in life, and that generation of video game fans who grew up in the 80s, like we're all hitting our 40s and we have kids and we have full-time jobs and we can't necessarily like, you know, just hunker down in front of the TV the way that we used to, but we can totally pick up a Steam Deck or a Switch, or, you know, my Analog Pocket gets a lot of play because I can pick it up and I can play it, you know, like while I'm waiting for, you know, something in the oven, and I'm standing in the kitchen and I have 15 minutes to kill before the oven timer goes off. I can easily just pick up my Analog Pocket and, you know, play some games, hit suspend, and then get back into real life. And I think that that's why we're seeing a resurgence in handheld gaming. But a Steam Deck costs hundreds of dollars, a Switch, which everybody like, you know, acknowledges is like old tech, right? Like it's like the Switch is kind of falling apart at this point, but it still costs hundreds of dollars to get one new. And I don't know how we get back to a place where, you know, a kid might like realistically be able to afford to buy themselves a game console and then games to go with it.
Yeah, I just splurged this weekend and got the that Playdate, that cool little mini handheld.
It was
$200, you know. I'm like, it's fun for me, but like, that isn't something like a kid's gonna like think like, cool, I'll have like a little fun experience with. Like, they don't have $200 burn a hole in their pocket to buy something like that.
The market is like people like you and me, right? Like a bit older, have nostalgia for those older, that older style of game, and it, you know, might have a little bit of extra money that we can spend on it, but it's not not, you know, something kids are saving up their money for. It's not V-Bucks.
Yeah.
So kids don't want it.
My kids are all about Roblox, so they just want that Robux money. But cool. Yeah, that GBA is that's a fun one. That takes me back too. I also, like, as you mentioned, you being a JRPG fan, like I am a huge one as well. So all those same games, like having Tales of Phantasia, the Final Fantasy 4, 5, and 6, like having Tactics Advance, like there's like a lot of great games on there. But like one of my other favorite games of all time, like from the PlayStation, was Castlevania Symphony of the Night, and there was three of those on the Game Boy Advance as well. So like like there was just,
I still
so
think
much.
Like Aria of Sorrow, I still think is the best Castlevania game, like even above like Symphony of the Night, even above Dawn of Sorrow. Like to me, Aria of Sorrow was like the peak. They figured it out, and it was perfect for that handheld console.
It looked great, it played great, it sounded great. Like and then I did have a Game Boy player, and so I think I remember like Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga, like it was like enhanced to be played on there, and so I just like the idea of being able to like play on the go, but then come home and put it on the TV and like kind of continue to play, like, you know, years later. That would be a possibility, but but cool. The Game Boy Advance, that's a great answer. I think that's awesome. I think that that kind of does it then for this. The podcast is this. We answer the one question and we move on and we're done.
Love it.
So thank you so much for jumping in here. We will definitely have you back on future episodes. And like I said, if you wanted to follow along and kind of see Aiden stuff, look at the show notes and the details. There'll be links and everything down below. But thank you so much for jumping on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
welcome to another episode. I've got my lifelong friend, Austin, with us. Another episode. It's been a minute since you've been on the show. Hello, Austin.
Hey.
So let's do an icebreaker question. So one's gonna, let's do a newer one. Yeah, let's do, well, I like this one. So while I don't condone throwing controllers, what is a memorable controller throwing moment you've had playing a game?
Oh boy.
Just a tough or a challenging moment in a game, or something that's brought you to some frustration potentially.
Yeah, I don't think I have a very specific one with me doing it. Although I know that I have done it, especially as you know, a younger child, and just not being able to control emotions as well, probably. But like, I definitely want to say that happened in It's usually in a competitive atmosphere, I feel like, mm-hmm. in the times that it's come up with me. So I would say like the GoldenEye 007, those kind of heated matches. I'm sure that I had, you know, done it at some point. And probably even in like those awesome Nintendo 64 wrestling games. I'm sure that had came up at some point. The first controller throwing memory that really comes to mind, it wasn't me throwing the controller, but it was my older brother, Doug. We were playing Street Fighter II. On the Super Nintendo. And I was like, you know, a little kid and doing that kind of cheap, like, oh, I'm just going to do like a leg sweep move over and over again. And it was just like, I was defeating him and like had won, I think maybe even the first round. And he just lost it eventually and like just ripped my controller out of the thing and tossed it. so not on me throwing it, but that's the only like specific memory I have of someone chucking a controller like that.
So you created the controller being thrown
with
your tactics.
Exactly.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. Those like, revenge matches. I mean, I guess all the wrestling games matches, but those did bring some, I think, heated competition out and all that stuff. I don't know why you were, but I don't know why you were the, you know, especially around the revenge era, you would often be the one who'd win a lot of the times.
Yeah.
But I say that like implying that you're like, oh, you're not good at video games. So I don't know why you were the one who's winning, but I feel like like that was like really specific. Like I can remember me and Thomas going like back to back against you and like losing like back to back and all that stuff. And like we're both like just demanding like another go at it, losing to you and all that stuff. And that was like a good one, I think, cause it was more kind of suited to like one-on-one. Whereas like once you started getting into like No Mercy, you wanted to kind of play with some of the gimmicks and like more of the custom characters and more of like the ladder and table matches, like that type of stuff. But revenge, I remember some tough matches.
I seem to recall, I think it was me and you that were going against Thomas, because he must have been pretty dominant at a certain stretch, you know, especially, I don't remember which specific game, but we had done like a handicap match, I think. Mm. And it was, I believe the two of us were like, we're winning, you know, it was 2-on-1. And I think he didn't throw the controller, he got up and ripped the cartridge out.
Cartridge throwing moment.
He didn't throw the cartridge, but he did remove it before he lost or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fuck this. I'm out. Actually, wait. Was there a time I was choked by you and it was threatened to not mess with the mafia? Was that playing a video game?
We were actually watching. I was kind of just playing around. We were watching a basketball game. It was like the Utah Jazz, the playoff game. You know, it wasn't really. It's supposed to be serious. I didn't have mistakes in either of those games. Man, I was kind of just fucking around.
Yeah, I just remember was threatened to not mess with the mafia, specifically.
That's the Mormon mafia.
Oh, yeah, that was the Jazz and Sonics, maybe. Maybe it was the Western Conference playoff battle.
Yeah, it was something, low stakes for us, being not fans of either team playoff.
You know, fans of the Western Conference, you know. I guess. I want to see the Bulls win it again, because that was what happened. Cool. All right. Well, then that does that. That's the icebreaker. So let's move into the main event. The primary question I wanted to ask for this episode was, what is your favorite game console of all time? So I've asked one before about this, like specifying like handheld, but I figured, you know, just modifying this to just being just general like console. So it could be a handheld, but, you don't have to like limit it to that at all. Just a system that played video games. What is your favorite of all time, you think?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say it's an easy answer for me, because it's not completely easy. There's some, you know, some ones that I'm really, really fond of, and for just different reasons. I mean, the Dreamcast was really cool, and, you know, you just wish, you know, that maybe had a different kind of life, how that could have gone. But I think my answer is kind of boring, unfortunately. But for me, it's the Switch. It's the Nintendo Switch. It is. And it, honestly, it's kind of like far and away for me, my favorite. And it might say, I mean, it's, I try not to succumb to like recency bias. I really do try to be aware of that, or like nostalgia, you know, it can go, kind of go either way. But when I just think about it, it's like, okay, my favorite series is The Legend of Zelda. There's two, and probably my two favorite of all the series, original Zelda games, right there, you know, Tears of the Kingdom, Breath of the Wild. Mm-hmm. They did that really awesome Link's Awakening remake.
Well,
just recently, now I'm playing.
You had experienced Breath of the Wild as a Wii U owner, so I mean, you know, if you're going to lump that into the Switch, you know, I mean, that's just kind of some generational gaps. But yeah,
maybe that one deserves an asterisk. And then also now there's another new original title, Echoes of Wisdom, and then you know, on top of that, there's like the Skyward Sword HD, you know, remaster or whatever. I don't know if that really counted as a remake, but so there's a lot of just like, that's a lot of like to get three. I mean, yeah, one of them is a simultaneous Wii U release, but three original titles is awesome. The amount of like original Mario titles that came out in there is also not bad. I mean, you got Odyssey, which is probably my favorite 3D one, and then Wonder was also really good.
Mario Maker 2? Is that a Switch?
Yeah, Mario Maker
2. Yeah.
Yeah. And then some awesome ports of some Wii U Mario games that I missed, like that 3D world with Bowser's Fury. That Bowser's Fury section was like really, really cool. Mm-hmm. Like one of my most probably fond, like it was a shorter experience with like Mario 3D Mario experiences, like at all. So yeah, my answer is mostly going to be just software related, because I just think it really like just hit on all cylinders. Pikmin 4 was really cool. Some of these smaller series, Advance Wars 1 and 2 Reboot Camp. I mean, I don't think that sold very well, unfortunately, but that was really cool. Mm-hmm. And the other neat thing about it, too, is that because the thing was so successful, I think it exposed a lot of people to these kind of smaller Nintendo series that maybe hadn't played them before. Like, I think Luigi's Mansion 3, that was another great game, was also, like, really successful. Or, like, Fire Emblem Three Houses, people, like, loved the shit out of that. It's, like, these series that weren't necessarily, like, I would say maybe they're futures might have been a little shaky. We're like, okay, well, this is firmly like, you know, you can warrant trying a sequel out and seeing if they can, you know, keep some momentum going with these. They maybe had found some new fans. So I think, I mean, that's not why I love the console, but that's just like a cool aside.
Mm-hmm.
And then what's cool too is like, if you're a fan of like, if you want to like revisit old games, and this is kind of true of a lot of the consoles this generation, but there's a lot of really cool collections on there. You know, if you want to play like old Final Fantasies or Mega Mans or Castlevanias, and then obviously the Nintendo ones, I mean, they had like the, you could play every Pikmin that's ever been released on that thing, which is mm-hmm. neat. Obviously Nintendo still struggles with like the online stuff. That's still an issue. I do like that they provide like their little selection of retro games, you know, up until the Nintendo 64 on there. So if you want to get, you know, even place like even older other more Zelda games that are on like the Game Boy Advance, like, well, you can do that there. That's really cool. And I think when I saw the form factor for it too, I think that was like a really cool, fun and clever design. I mean, there'd been some rumors leading up to it, so it wasn't necessarily shocking that it was sort of a hybrid, but the Joy-Cons and the way that kind of, you know, slides on and off, I think that was a clever way of doing it, you know? Mm-hmm. It was underutilized, but they did incorporate, like, I think they called it like HD Rumble, which they like almost mm-hmm. never used, but it was almost, you know, something along the lines, not as good as what the PS5 has done with their was it just like haptic feedback kind of a technology, right?
Yeah, they haven't used that much, I mean, outside of like Astro, like that really cool like Astro experiments, like they've done with both of those. Not any other games really like dove in and used those haptics like the way that you can.
But Astro at least was like, I mean, because I think the best example I can think of for the Switch was probably like 1-2 Switch, which mm-hmm. is, you know, a pretty kind of a more or less throwaway party game, launch game, you know. So I think they've probably done at least just having a couple of really awesome, yeah. you know,
Yeah, I'm not big on the Switch. I think you know that. I just was burned. I feel like when I lost my 3DSs, I felt like burned by Nintendo, and so like just trying to figure that out. But like, you know, you can't deny like what it's done for people. And like, what's crazy to think is like, I mean, literally your experience that you're explaining, like it comes from clearly like a place of like love and appreciation for like Nintendo's core franchises and like their development efforts and like kind of more like their bigger properties and everything. Like you could probably ask somebody else who would say the Switch is their favorite console, but specifically point to like all of like the indie games and downloadable, like small, like scale, like independent releases and like the catalog of support they've had from that whole end of the spectrum. Like Nintendo's never really had that on a system. So like you have like all those re-releases and things like that you're talking about, but also like people are not missing or skipping a Switch release for their like independent or like smaller like scale quote unquote like game. So like to be able to play all those types of things plus like what you're saying, like I mean you're getting like a full AAA console experience of releases, you know, from Nintendo, but on top of that, like, you know, there's also that entire like underworld there of stuff that, you know, people like there's people who most likely you've asked them that question, they would say the same thing, but for that exact reason, just specifically because of all the indies and like bonus scoop. And it's like, oh yeah, then you have all these cool Nintendo games too. So,
well, yeah, I wanted to get to that too. Cause I've played so many, like this is the most like indie games I've played on like a console for sure. Like I would dabble before, but I routinely play, you know, a cool indie that I hear about. And they were fortunate that way too, where there are some that like would come out first on the Switch, if not, you know, simultaneously, or at least maybe a console first. And they did tend to trickle, you know, down to the other consoles eventually, but like, it was cool, you know, being able to do that. Like Golf Story, when that came out, that was that was just so much fun to have that, like, and you know, that experience. Or like, just so many indie games I've really enjoyed on there. Celeste, and you know, I mean,
yeah,
there's just, yeah, that's a good point though. Yeah, the indies are like on its own, I think, would be the only thing with those is you got to be willing to pay more than you would on Steam, but whatever. I like to play on the Switch.
So. Yeah, I'm not a person who's going to fight you on that, just being like a primary like console player and everything, like, you know, everything you can get maybe cheaper or simpler or whatever you want on a PC, but you also have to build it, update it, and you know, there's a whole world there that I just don't want to get involved with. I love the plug and play formula of just console games, or just pick up and go of like the Switch's case, where you can just, you know, pick it up and move and download it, everything you want and everything. I don't think it's a boring answer. I think it's, you know, I think it just speaks to the power of Nintendo. I mean, like, they definitely, I think, had some adversity. Like, they've had, like, outside of the GameCube, like, you know, they had a string of, like, things that I think were perpetually, oh, I guess I'm skipping the Wii. But the Wii was a financial success. I don't know if it was, like, a creative or, like, core gamer success, per se. I think that definitely financed them to, like, they weren't going to go anywhere, of course, but, like, it definitely just, like, gave them, like, a reset button so that they could, like, kind of continue to experiment the way they want to do it and make the games they want to make and do so without, like, any other concern there. But, like, yeah, the Switch is like, I feel like, brought Nintendo back to a place where, you know, NES, Super NES, N64, but like with significant support externally on top of like their best outputs, you know, internally, all in one system.
Yeah, I would agree. It's funny. This is off topic, but it's funny that you mentioned the GameCube. When you look at how the sales of the thing, it actually really didn't sell very well. I think its sales numbers are comparable to the Xbox. But then when you factor in, so I'd be curious to look at regions for that, because then when you factor in the Xbox sold basically nothing in Japan, then that probably means the Xbox maybe did better in like North America and Europe possibly. And then, you know, Nintendo did fine enough in those markets, and then more so in Japan, I'm guessing. But yeah, I always thought of that as a fairly successful console. For sure, the games, it had some really nice games on there, but I don't think like from like a financial or like sales thing, I don't think it was really setting the world on fire.
That's true. Yeah, I was kind of thinking more of like the gaming output and everything. Like Nintendo's pretty consistent with that, because like what, like the Wii, like while they started with some core games, like I really feel like Nintendo like wasn't sure what to do with their own internal developed games, and like, yeah, it was kind of a struggle there. And then Wii U, it was like the same thing. Like, it was such experimental hardware that they didn't get to put out as many, like a quantity of original games or so. I don't know the reason why, but it just feels like you mentioned, you just rattled off a bunch of Zelda games. Like they have, you know, and multiple like developmental like scope and scale the Zelda games, like original ones on this one, like that's more than were on the Wii and Wii U combined, you know, like without kind of like re-releases and things like that, and that span of things. So I mean, I guess you could say it's getting a little long in the tooth as far as like how long it's been around, but like
it's time.
Yeah, like I honestly feel like an update there is like if they just focus primarily on like the UI and like the package and presentation that all these games live in, and then ensure that like, you know, these Switch 1 games are compatible with it, like I don't think they can really fail at that point. You know, it's like PS2, like, you know, like yeah, you can play all these old PS1 games and we're going to build some better, bigger and better stuff, like sure, like, yeah, they had the benefit of like having, you know, being a DVD player for DVD households player, and all that stuff, but I mean, yeah, if they did something like smart around, like, it's obviously going to be a $300 or $250 priced thing, you know, bumping the hardware, like that would be good. But yeah, the Switch, that's a good choice. I think it's a cool choice. So I think it makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, obviously a big Nintendo fan, so it's like, okay, they're putting out at least one first party title a month throughout the life of this thing. It's like, that's going to kind of be right up my alley. And then, like you said, as far as if there's maybe one that I'm not super hot on, or it's maybe a smaller experience, there's always like the indies to play. And also too, early on for the Switch, they were able to port, you know, some of those bigger, like last generation or you know, let's figure out a way to get Skyrim kind of on it type of a thing. So there was plenty to play for me on there.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, that's going to do it then. Anything else you want to share or say before we wrap up? Otherwise, it's the end of the episode.
No, I don't think so. I'm just really enjoying this Echoes of Wisdom so far. Only gotten like two dungeons in, but it's super fun.
Yeah. All right. I think I've been watching somebody play that on Twitch, so it's been looking really cool. So it definitely looks like it's an enjoyable one for sure. But cool. Thanks for joining me, Austin. We will definitely have you more episodes soon in the future.
Great, thanks.
Like.